Hello and welcome to episode 29 of Soft Spot, which you hopefully know is the podcast of the Global Soft Foundation. I'm your host and director of marketing for the foundation, Chelsea Hamishan. I'm here today with another episode that we recorded during the demo days that we had in November. So GSF President Stu Braden and I recorded this in our makeshift studio in a fifth wheel at the Range Complex in North Carolina. Because of that, you might hear some gunshots in the background, but don't worry, it was just people trying out different tech and ammo at demo days. Our guest in today's episode is actually one of the masterminds behind the Range Complex, an awesome space about 30 minutes outside of Fort Bragg, North Carolina, that offers Tier 1 customized tactical training and shooting courses. It's basically a really cool range with lots of flexibility and different opportunities for training. The Range Complex is one of our corporate partners, and because it is such a cool spot, it only made sense to have our demo days there. Anyways, like I was saying, one of the men behind the Range Complex, or TRC, is U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel retired Jimmy Reese, and he was good enough to join us in the fifth wheel for a conversation about his career. He talks about his out-of-order path to get into the Army, the Rangers, and ultimately SF. We hit on how 9/11 changed things and what advanced force operations are. Then we dive into a discussion of Operation Anaconda, including a look into the Battle of Tucker Gar in Afghanistan. And then we wrap things up with a look at being an entrepreneur after over two decades of military service. So listen up. Here's our discussion with Stu and Jimmy Reese.
And then if we want to break it down.
The Global Soft Foundation.
My immediate reaction was, this is awesome. The Special Operations Community. For
Special Operations. You have our support. Let's move.
Welcome to Soft Spot.
So where's home for you originally? Or where do you declare home? I mean, I know you're living in Tennessee and Nashville right now.
Yeah.
But what's home for you? Like, where were you born?
I was born in Panama. My dad was the commander of the jungle school down in Sherman.
Yeah.
Back in the 60s.
Yeah.
So I was born down there, spent 2 years, and we came back to the States. My dad then got off active duty, was in the Guard, and started working for the federal government. Got a federal government job. And so we lived out west for a bunch of years, Seattle, Idaho, and then just like everybody gets promoted.
Yeah.
I get that GS-14 job and come to D.C. So I went to high school, junior high and high school in D.C. So Maryland, you know, Rockville, Maryland. So that's where I kind of grew up.
So you joined the Army out of high school?
I didn't. I had a little brother who did, wanted to be an airborne ranger. From the time, I didn't want anything to do with the Army. I knew my dad was in it, didn't know anything about it. You know, I wanted to go to college, you know, play football, chase girls, you know, do whatever. And so I did. I went to college on a football scholarship at a small school. And did
that school?
Mansfield University at Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
The first NCAA night.
Chelsea's from Pennsylvania. So
all right, Chelsea.
My family is.
They're all Steeler fans.
Oh, okay.
My mom's from outside of Scranton.
My mom and dad are from Scranton.
Really?
That could be related.
Same trailer park.
That's right. Up in the Poconos.
Yeah. That's where we used to go skiing all the time when I was little.
Are you a Steelers fan also?
No, I'm a Redskins fan.
He's a diehard Steeler. Yeah.
Really? From Scranton? Really?
Well, my dad's.
Usually they're Giants.
My dad's from Freeport outside of Pittsburgh.
Okay. Yeah, so I mean, my family's from Pennsylvania, but. We moved a lot. It was great. We were just my brother and I, but we got to experience a lot of cool things growing up, you know, traveling. My parents, you know, summer times we'd take the Volkswagen, the Apache tent trailer, and leave Seattle and drive all the way down to Mexico, come back up the Grand Canyon, up to Canada, Banff. I mean, all those cool things you did
awesome.
In the 60s and 70s.
So did you go into ROTC? Is that your start?
So, yeah. My dad asked me. So my freshman year, he says,
what are you going to do with your life?
Well, would you just look at ROTC?
Now, why would he do that? Because you were calm, young, well-disciplined.
Exactly.
Straight
yeah.
A's.
Exactly.
Yeah, no. He's like, hey, you can't drink yourself.
So my little brother was already at 175.
Oh.
So he was already there. So still, didn't know anything. You know, airborne ranger, you know, hard as woodpecker lips. Whatever, dude. You know, I'm going to college. But I joined the ROTC. You know, I was the long-haired hippie. ROTC kid. And oh, by the way, they suckered me into joining the guard at the same time, which
same thing happened to me.
Joining ROTC, doing good. Yeah. Delayed entry program to get this. So what really caught me though was after my freshman year, going into my sophomore year, getting ready to go to camp, football camp, the PMS called. They called the PMS, right? ROTC, and he goes, "Hey, we've got a slot to airborne school. The person who was going broke their ankle, and there's no one else in shape. Do you want to go?" I had no idea what airborne school was. He goes, "You know, jump out of airplanes." So I said, "Okay,
sounds cool."
Mm-hmm. You know, so my mom and dad put me on a bus in down Union Station in Washington, D.C., and I got on that 19-hour bus ride to Fort Benning, Georgia. Oh. Mm-hmm. And my brother.
Dreams are made.
Exactly. And, you know, I the funny thing, I remember getting there and people screaming and yelling, and, you know, I just wouldn't. That didn't affect me because I didn't realize who all these guys in black hats were. So they said, "You know, you're in the 43rd company, blah, blah." I said, "Okay." So I walk in and find myself a room, find myself a bunk, and I walk in. Half hour later, all these big, tan, blonde-headed dudes come running this room, grabbing bunks. They're all these guys going through SEAL training.
Yeah.
So they're SEALs that...
They have nice hair.
Nice hair.
They refuse to cut their hair in jump school.
You know,
they take the beating from the black hats, the instructors.
They do.
But they refuse. That's part of the game. They refuse to cut their hair.
And they take a beating, but they're
hard.
Good.
Yeah, I love them for it.
They do.
It's fun to watch, isn't it?
It is fun.
They're just tough.
Yeah. So I went through jump school and I passed, and my little brother came out and pinned my wins on me. But still, fast forward sophomore year, junior year, doing it. You know, now I'm an ROTC, and I dropped out of school because I lost my football scholarship. And Daddy Bear said, "Because you ain't coming home, you can get a job, join the military, or join the Peace Corps, but you're not coming home and living under my roof and floundering." So I called my brother and I was crying. My brother said, "Go see this recruiter down the street." So I did, same recruiter my brother had. Next thing you know, I'm back on that bus to Fort Benning, Georgia for
another great, lovely trip.
Basic training with my jump wings.
Ooh.
So I'm a PV2.
How bad did that go, man?
It's bad to have your wings already, and then
you kind of skipped a move.
The spotlight. Who's this guy?
Killer, you know, man, you think you've got it going on.
Yeah. So I enlisted, and you know, I enlisted for a Ranger, for the Ranger option. So I got all that. Yeah. So I finished at Benning, got everything. I got the Savannah, again. So now I got a little brother, who's an E5.
And you're a nobody.
I'm a nobody. I'm Sergeant Reach's big brother.
Oh.
So all the Spec 4 tab guys.
Treat you.
Oh, man. I got smoked like a
big. You couldn't get the Ranger school fast enough, man. As soon as you get the Ranger tab, it's like.
It's over with. But
yeah. But until then, you pay the man.
Yeah. And it's funny is that the tie-in at the time, I mean, the names that came out of that are just it's a history lesson. And
what year was that?
That was 1984. Let's see, 84, 85.
So you did that for how many years?
I did that for 3 years. And then the Army, I made rank quick because I had 130 college credits.
Yeah, you're almost there.
So I made Army, I made rank real fast. And then I went to another promotion board. And the battalion commander at the time was a guy by the name of Buck Kernan.
Oh, no, well, man.
General Kernan, who was good. Good
he
mentor.
Said, "We're going to make you an officer."
Well,
son.
He said to me, he says, "Hey, man, you got 130 college credits. Have you thought about
becoming an officer?"
Becoming an officer. Oh, sir, I hate officers. Yeah. You know,
Except you, sir.
Yeah. You know? He says, "Okay." He says, "Well, you know." And so I remember we went home for block leave, and I said to my dad, Colonel Kernan said, "Why don't you do this?" My dad pulled out the pay chart. He says, "Here, brother. E501.
This is where you could be."
And then about 6 months later, we were out in the field, and Kernan said, he goes, "Hey, got a buddy of mine who's the commander of the 28th Infantry Division, Pennsylvania National Guard."
Bloody Bucket.
So he said to me, he goes, "Hey, he has a position for a detachment sergeant for his LRS." Could be an E6 position. They could come down a rank. Okay. We've checked it out. We've got permission from cadet command that you can go back to your same school. Don't lose anything. Do a year.
Yeah, this time don't screw it up.
Don't screw it up. Go back and get commissioned. So I did. So that year is, you know, so I was an E6 and I was an AGR guy. Yeah, so active guard reservist, doing the LRS thing, which was cool. And
long-range reconnaissance.
Kind of what AFO should have been.
Yeah,
you know, should have been.
You will walk. You don't ride.
But the funny thing
was not an option.
The funny thing was is, you know, so here I was, I did this year, and I'm coming up on graduation, and the general who commanded cadet command at the time, they said, "Well, you're not getting commissioned because you've never been to RTC Advanced Camp." I said, "Yeah, but I'm the distinguished honor graduate from Ranger School." And he goes, "Yeah, but you didn't go through Ranger School as a cadet. You went through as enlisted. So now you've got to go to Advanced Camp."
So you did a few things out of order.
I did a few things, which is my life. I do everything out of order.
So where'd you go first out of AOB? Where'd you?
Korea. 2ID. Yep, 2ID.
You did that because you knew you wanted to go back to the Rangers?
No, actually, a guy by the name of Colonel Hunt, who was the 375 commander at the time, offered me to come to 375 as a second lieutenant.
Yeah.
And I was all fired up. But Kernan was the regimental commander. He brought me into his office because I was at OBC.
Said, "You need to go to the conventional army."
Jimmy, he says, "Let me tell you something. If Colonel Hunt wants you, I will allow it." He says, "But have I ever steered you wrong?" And I said, "No, sir." He says, "Look, you came out of being an NCO. If you go back being a second lieutenant, you're not an NCO anymore." He says, "Let us send you to Korea for a year. See what being an army lieutenant, best move I ever made."
Yeah.
I made two great moves in my career, and both of them were the conventional. So I went to be a second lieutenant at Korea, which was awesome. First battalion commander was Dave Grange.
Well, you might as well be in Ranger Battalion.
Yeah, yeah.
And it worked. Because he ran it like that.
But I learned a lot, yeah. You know, and I got to lead real soldiers up on the DMZ and all that stuff. So that was cool. Came back, went to 275 because I was second lieutenant. You know, that's when everyone went 2 years as second lieutenant before you make first lieutenant.
Yeah.
And I didn't have to go to any schools after OBC. So, boom, I was out the door, came right back, and then I spent from second lieutenant to captain at 275. Kevin Nolans was one of my company commanders.
Oh, yeah, love him, yeah.
And Kevin was also one of my lieutenants when I was enlisted. So
that's
was cool.
Awesome.
That was his XO at the time.
Kevin Owens has the greatest thing. So when he was the 275 commander, you have three major field grades, right? This is Van Smiley telling me this story. Mm-hmm. And Kevin was like, "Hey, look, I ain't doing paperwork. I mean, that's bullshit. I did that as a major. So you majors about to do some paperwork." And so he went and got those little stamps, you know, that you sign your name and everything.
Yeah.
He had three of them, right? This Van tells me, he says, he lays out pieces of paper in front of all three of them. He says, "I want you to practice stamping my name. Because if you stamp it too hard, it'll put like ink ring around it and everything.
You'll realize it was a stamp.
So I want you to get a nice touch to it so it looks like my signature." Once he had done the and he approved it, he goes, "All right, good. Because I'm going to go command the battalion. Y'all doing the paperwork." And he goes, "Handle this stuff." So when you made the move, like, and you finished at the Rangers and you went to the advanced course and everything, is that when you decided you wanted to go through selection?
No. Being the Rangers and being in JSOC, you were always around the unit guys, but I never thought. I thought I was going to be a Ranger, Ranger Battalion Commander, Ranger Regimental Commander.
Then you had a good haircut and everything.
Oh, yeah. I had... You know, my oldest daughter just sent me a picture with my high and tight.
Yeah, they do like to remind you, don't they?
They do. So all my peers were going SF. And I was like, the SF thing just wasn't, I don't know, it just wasn't catching my drift. But when now guys are going, "Hey, go become an SFA team leader and command 12 guys." Like, I just did 45.
Yeah.
Again, I get it now. But so I stayed infantry. And if you remember when I came to CGSC, I stayed infantry. So I left, you know, the infantry branch said, "Well, you are Rangers is light. So now you got to go command heavy."
Heck, I remember that. Oh, you're like, "Oh, hell no."
And so they said, "You're going to Fort Hood, Texas." I showed up the 1st Cavalry Division. You know, again, it's fortuitous. Years later, 9/11, after all my experiences now in the unit, all the soft things, integrating soft, which we did with ILE and all that, and meeting. What happens after 9/11? All the guys who are running the Army were my commanders at the 1st Cav. Shinseki, McKiernan, Webster, Spider Marks.
Schoonmaker was a DC.
Schoonmaker. General Casey.
Yep.
You know, all those guys were battalion and brigade commanders when I was there, which was great for me because I was the only guy in JSOC they knew.
Knew.
So
who were all these other guys?
So I did 2 years there. did 6 months on the staff, commanded 18 months, and best move, best 2 years of my life. You know, McKiernan made me the advance guard and counter recon guy for the brigade. Gave me every infantryman. He gave me 12 tanks and 16 Bradleys. He goes, "You're my advance guard counter recon guy. Make it happen." I didn't even know what that meant. You know? And I remember I had a master gunner. He goes, you know, big master gunner, had Mountain Dew and smoking cigarettes all the time. He goes, "Sir, if you ever touch that slough, I'll cut your hand off." Yeah. You know, and he'd drive that thing with his feet. I really took a lot out of that.
So what made you want to go through selection?
We were at about 8 or 9 months earlier, we were at a JRT or a JRX, whatever they're called, out at Fort Bliss. And I sat one night on the ramp of a weather night with a guy by the name of Major Tony Thomas. And he just started, and he goes, "Hey, man, we're starting to look at other ways, different officers." And he just started talking to me. 6, 7 months later, we have the Delta recruiter, the Delta recruitment brief. And guess who's there? Tony Thomas. Gives the whole brief. And then he says, "Hey, we're trying to recruit more Ranger officers to come to the unit. So here's the deal. You come to selection, you pass, you go back and you do your command. And then when you're done with command, then you come to OTC." It's win-win for everybody. Yeah, I mean, it's win-win.
You get your cake and you get to eat it.
So, you know, all the field grades are in the back. And Tony goes, "So anybody interested?" I'm like,
"Whoosh." Yeah.
How many hands do you think went up in the room?
One.
Jimbo. And then Owens and Bannister, "You disloyal.
You disloyal.
You know, what are you doing? You blah, blah,
you just
blah.
Want to grow your hair long. Yeah, exactly. Smoke dope."
I'm like, dude, I get the, I mean, so I went through selection. Incredible experience. Eldon Barjo was the unit commander. And he says to me, he goes, "Jim," he says, "we'd like to change the rules on you. So we want you to come now." And I said, "Sir, look," he says, "the Rangers let me come here under these auspices. You know, I don't know if I can do that." He says, "It's not up to you." Colonel King comes to me. He says, "Hey, Colonel McChrystal's coming to town. He wants you to pick him up at the airport because we're doing bilats." He says, "And you're going to drive him down to the training. And he wants to see you." I said, "Okay." So I go pick up Colonel McChrystal.
See Uncle Stan. Yes, sir. Every man, tell me you weren't nervous.
I was nervous.
Yes, you were.
I was nervous.
Yes, you were.
I was nervous. And he says, "Hey," he says, "first off, I'm not making this decision. This is your decision. This is your decision. And I want to know in 72 hours before I leave here. So you're going to pick me up on Thursday. And you're going to tell me what your decision is, young man."
Sucks.
You know? So I said, "Okay, sir." So, you know, went back, went to do bilats Thursday afternoon, went and got the, you know, went and got the SUV, picked him up, and we drove in silence all the way back to Savannah Airport. And so we're pulling. He goes, "So what's your decision?" I said, "Sir, can I ask you one question?" He says, "Absolutely. You ask me anything you want." I said, "If you were in my shoes, what would you do?" And he kind of looked at me and he said, "Touche." But I kind of said, "Man, how do you not get drafted by the New York Yankees and go, I'm going to wait.
I need to stay in the AAA.
I'm going to stay AAA for a couple more years and try to hit
no three. Downgrade to the Rangers.
Yeah, no, not at all.
If you're going, you're going. If you're not, you're not.
You're not, yeah. So, you know, Colonel McChrystal gave me some interesting insight. And he goes, "So, Jimmy, what's your...
Did
what's
he
your,
tell you what he would do? He just
No, he kind of...
Let you deal with that turd.
He said he had some opportunities in this, and this is what this can do. And so I said to him, I said, "Sir, I'm going now."
And so you did that until you went to Fort Leavenworth. Met the greatest instructor in the world, my brother. He was in my brother's small group. So that's how I got to know Jimmy the first. Because my brother goes, "Hey, man, I got this Delta guy in my thing, and you probably ought to spend more time talking to him."
Now, the Rangers has this prototype, but now you're coming to a new organization like SF that there's all kinds of
different personalities
and different focuses. And, you know, I watched some short, bearded, chubby guy who I was kind of literally almost make me die on the obstacle course. You know, if Mike Pannone, who's former Mike, had his eye blown out. If it wasn't for Mike Pannone, I would never made it through OTC. Never. He taught me how to climb a rope and he taught me how to break down a 45, you know, because, you know, the rest of the army, it's, you know, you move as fast as the slowest common denominator. Here, now you move as fast as the fastest common denominator. If you don't keep up, you're out. Yeah. I remember they handed me a 45. Never forget it. "Sometime during this course, you'll have to, you know, disassemble, assemble, and do a function chuck on a 45. It was Friday night. We're going drink beers and go to El Chico's, and we've been training all week. They'll get to that in about 2 months, you know, like the rest of the Army does. So I had time to practice. Monday afternoon, everyone in the team rooms, break out your 45s. Here we go. I didn't even know how to clear a 45 at that time. So I, you know, Sergeant Major brings me and got counseled. He goes, "Hey, you get one more, you miss up, you're out." Oh my God.
After all this.
So I go to Mike Pannone, who was an 18 Bravo SF guy. I go, "Mike, dude, I will buy you dinner for the rest of your life if you teach me how to climb a rope and how to," and he goes, "Come on, brother." Man, I'll tell you, just incredible, humbling.
The next part of this conversation talks a lot about Operation Anaconda, so I wanted to provide a brief background before it gets started. Operation Anaconda took place in early March 2002. It was a major effort to clear out the remaining Al-Qaeda fighters and their Taliban allies in Shah Aqat Valley. The mission involved about 2,000 coalition troops, including more than 900 Americans, 200 U.S. Special Forces and other troops, and 200 Special Operations troops from Australia, Canada, Denmark, Germany, France, Norway, New Zealand, and Afghan allies. The initial plan was for Afghan forces to attack the enemy from the north and force them south, where U.S. troops were waiting. It did not start off well for the Allied forces, and what was expected to last 72 hours lasted more than 2 weeks. This discussion with Jim Reese focuses mostly on one specific part of Anaconda, the Battle of Thakur Gar, also now called the Battle of Roberts Ridge. Thakur Gar was a mountain along the Shah Aqat Valley with a ridge codenamed Objective Ginger, a valuable high ground with a commanding view of the entire Anaconda battle space. Two Allied MH-47 Chinook helicopters were hit by heavy fire from small arms and RPGs as they approached Thakur Gar. They managed to fly off, but soon found that Navy SEAL Neil Roberts was no longer on board. The rescue attempt led to an 18-hour battle in which 6 more Americans died. Needless to say, it was not a good day for the U.S. or our partner nations. Let's hear what Stu and Jimmy have to say about it.
One of the things I want to talk about is your AFO experience. Kind of tell everybody what Advanced Force Operations is all about. And I just, me personally, I think it's, you know, everybody's trying to go high tech. These guys went low tech. And they went old school. I mean, everybody in old school goes, "Damn, man, that's some hard stuff." The Battle at Thakur Gar, there's more. 2 Medal of Honors came out of that. I don't know how many Silver Stars, Bronze Stars. We lost a lot of people. We lost a lot of Rangers up there. We lost a lot of SEALs up there. It's probably one of the biggest fights. It was much bigger, I assume, than Black Hawk Down. It was huge. It was a huge fight. We had a brigade of 101st.
The largest battle since Vietnam.
Yeah.
So in the right before 9/11, I guess it was the fall of 2000.
Yep.
There was kind of, where are we going next? Where's JSOC? Where's SOF going next? What are these new things we're looking at? And this concept of advanced force operations came up, which really is, like you said, kind of going, we turn the clocks back.
It's LRS for special ops.
Exactly. It's it's reconnaissance. And, you know, again, it was all in our doctrine, sending people across the flot or, you know, in behind enemy lines.
Deep
behind and reporting and staying there and high risk, high gain. But in the reality was no one was ever going to do it because it was too high risky. Now we learned it. We talked it. If we went to NTC or JRTC, we'd get out there and we'd die within 30 minutes because they find you. So everyone says, "Oh, too high risk." Well, someone came up with the concept of this advanced force operation. And it was really a combination of both doing it out in the field, whether it was jungle, but there was also a combination of now, how do we do this in an urban city environment, blending in with people, whether it's, you know, the way we look and clothes and all those type of things. So it was taking all the lessons learned, I'd probably say from Vietnam, right? The LRS guys and the
MACV SOG guys.
Eldon
Barjul.
Exactly. And General Beauregard, you know? Yeah.
We just had him in here earlier today, and he was talking about this.
So the doctrine was there. It was just trying to get people to do it. So I got asked to come out of the squadron and stand up this new, be part of standing up this new AFO cell, kind of out of JSOC, because they were going to take everybody and form these joint teams. And we were making it up as we go. And so we kind of worked that year, and then we were walking into a GRX, which was going to be the AFO in the fall of 01.
Big training exercise,
mm-hmm. which was going to be your validation.
Validation.
It's going to be the AFO yes. validation. So we've been almost a year on this thing. We're over in Europe and doing all this AFO stuff and OPB and OPE, and we're throwing all these new names out, and people's OERs were getting, you know.
It's reconnaissance.
Exactly. It's reconnaissance. Surveillance and reconnaissance. Nothing more. And, you know, we're in the middle of doing the op, and we were in the headquarters in Budapest, and 9/11 happened. Boom. Stop everything. Don't pass go. Don't collect $200. We're going to Afghanistan. So.
Yeah. So you guys did all that and everything, and you deployed. You were validated, right?
Correct.
They said, okay, congratulations. Here's your stamp of approval. But so you guys show up in Afghanistan, and then you get the mission to you know, and how do we prevent Al Qaeda from, you know, leaving Afghanistan and going into Pakistan and all these different things? Because, right. you know, I mean, we overwhelmed them pretty quick, right? I mean, we collapsed the whole thing pretty quick.
Yep.
But the fight wasn't close. Mm-hmm. And people knew that they were still enforced in certain pockets. We just didn't know exactly where.
Right.
And so that was where the AFO piece came into play.
Yeah.
So,
like you said, early on, I mean, this was a Green Beret mission early on, work with the G's, take the country down. But now you're in the middle of the country with all these pockets. So you're in the middle of a country. The Green Berets had taken, you know, gotten everybody set up. But now, how do we stabilize this company, country, where you're in the middle, and the whole combination of AFO, which I think, and I'm very proud of, was the whole fusion, the interagency fusion, you know, Green Berets running the G's, AFO going out and doing hard ass reconnaissance, you know,
long,
SR,
ugly.
You know, the interagency intelligence communities being there, sharing, you know, intelligence, being in Gardez, you know, in the middle of the night under candlelight, you know, running your MRSAT to get the reports out and doing all those things. Yeah. So as we planned Anaconda, the big thing was, how do you infiltrate? You know, and we were.
I talked to Mark Rosengard, who was the three, and he said that was the biggest thing. If you went in a helicopter, you might as well, you were compromised.
Right.
And no matter where they put you, they weren't ever sure they could ever get you back out again.
Right.
Because you were compromised.
Right.
And so the question is how do you do the reconnaissance without compromising the force?
You drive a part of the way, and then you walk the rest of the way. And, you know, and we spent weeks sending vehicles down the roads,
sensitizing
vehicles. We were doing false insertion. I mean, everything you learn at
false reconnaissance.
Good reconnaissance. Wait, look, wait till the weather. And then when the weather, snow, rain,
go.
Because the bad guys don't want to be
coming
out.
There,
coming out. And what I thought was amazing was watching these teams.
And these are teams of NCOs, right?
All NCOs.
All NCOs.
Yeah, Pete and I, we command and controlled.
Yeah.
They
did all
did
the
it,
heavy
you know?
Lifting.
And
yeah. God bless them, man.
The guys down the end, you know, they went to the far south, dropped off. I mean, my God, man, they were infiltrating in snow and walking across cliffs, you know, on their feet and getting to a position.
Handrailing it,
you know, and then CK's guys taking the ATVs for part of the way and then parking them and walking farther in. And,
the altitude's 9 to 14?
14, yeah. I mean,
1,000 feet.
1,000 feet. Yeah. And,
it's like being on top of Pikes Peak.
Yeah.
And heavy lifting at that altitude.
You know, that's now we're learning. You know, you got guys calling in. You know, and my job now was this: how do I keep these guys alive?
Yeah.
You know, and you got one team leader saying, "Hey, man, been out here 4 days. I need a resupply. I'm laying in the same hole for 4 days straight." I mean, no one's ever done. I mean, usually it was 24 hours at JRTC.
You're good.
You were in Afghanistan 4 days. You ain't moving. You're whispering, sending your crypto, and you know. We sent a helicopter out to offset, to kick it, you know, and they turn their lights on. You know, they're landing, you know, and you get some NCO screaming, "I'll kill you, motherfucker," because you just compromised them maybe, you know? So everyone's holding their breath, hoping, you know, we didn't compromise these guys who worked so hard to get in, but they didn't. And,
so their biggest mission was to report, right?
Report. And then a D-Day, H-Hour, was calling Cass.
Cass is close air support.
And so the plan was to get the 101st Brigade on the ground.
So the Rockesons, General Wozinski, Colonel Wozinski at the time, and they had the lead, so that brigade minus. But
that's a whole lot of helicopters.
A whole lot of helicopters. And, you know, our guys on the south, you know, they're the ones that walked up on that position that had the Dishka. And if they hadn't found that Dishka and taken it out of
machine gun.
They would have, because they had enfilade fire down the valley when all those Chinooks. So, I mean, they could have took out a company, a battalion minus, they could have taken out in just a couple rounds if they hadn't taken that gun out. So, so that was the mission was get 101st to 10th Mountain in, get the blocking positions, why Rosengard and Colonel Mulholland, you know, 5th Group, right? Fifth Group came down around the whale with all the Afghan Northern Alliance guys, the G's, you know, just like anything else. That's when the AC went third, you know, the Afghans start running away. The SF guys are trying to
Catch
some dogs, get him back in a fight. The AC-130 is shooting the wrong place, kills Chief.
Makes it harder to get him moving.
Exactly.
Yeah, we're definitely not
done. We're going home, and we've got helicopters coming in an hour. And we're being told by CENTCOM and National Command Authority, this is an Afghan fight. Push the Afghans into the fight. And now here comes the 101st, you know? So,
And they got on the thing, they got on the deck down there, and it just started getting really dicey. They started taking fire.
Started taking mortars, from the whale. And we were, at HR, we were hammering
the ridge
the ridge lines, B-52s and CAS. These guys were calling in CAS and CAS. And
AFO teams were mainly doing that? Were they? Doing the cover for it to get them in.
Now they were going from reporting now to calling in CAS.
There are a lot of combo problems, right? Because of the hills, they weren't getting clean SATCOM shots.
Well,
your AFO teams were the ones that became
the comms
do it for the whole damn operation, which is not what the plan was.
No, so Colonel Wozinski had a single channel TACSAT, and he's trying to talk back to the 10th Mountain talk where General Hagenbach was, and it's, that's where I was now. And so I just called my guy, said, hey, man, look up to your right. See that Black Hawk landed? The commanding's up there. He can't just walk up the hill and hand him your headset. 5 minutes. You know, all our guys have multi-channel TACSAT booming like AT&T. And so now we become, the AFO becomes a communications piece
for
the whole operation.
Yeah, wow. And you guys were in place and everything. And then, you know, things got a little dicey. And then, you know, the Takagar piece happened, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know.
Where were you and I? You were in the
top. I was running everything for General Hagenbach and them from the AFO. So Pete was forward. Yeah. Colonel Blaber was forward. And I
was he with the 101st?
No, he was in Gardez.
So,
and it moved with Colonel Mulholland.
Okay.
Right, so, he took a jump talk down there.
Yep.
He moved. And, we had done our Makou. Remember the old Makous?
Yeah.
And, you know, we had identified early on that Takagar was key terrain. Big K means we want it and they want it. So the chances of someone being up there is pretty damn good.
Yeah.
Whether you saw it or not, you plan that there was somebody there. And again, just like anything else, doesn't matter how great you are or where you're from, whether you're a New York Yankee or you're from JSOC, people make mistakes. It's not that they make mistakes. And the plan for that team to go in was to offset 5 kilometers and walk up Takagar. So if there was bad guys up there, they conduct a movement to contact, take out the threat, and now we own Takagar. However, just like everything else, a series of miscues happened. Their helicopter had left Gardez. They got put in a holding pattern because of a B-52 run. So they were burning gas. They had to go back to Gardez to get gas.
Oh, shit.
And then, again, miscommunication, people's commands taking over, not talking to the command that they're cut to, making decisions not within the tactical net, making outside. And, you know, someone said, hey, we're late. We'll never get to the top of Takugar. And I told one guy, I said, hey, if you can't get there, no problems. What do reconnaissance guys do? Go to ground.
Go to ground, baby.
Go to ground, hide. Yeah. Wait for the next period of darkness and go.
Try
we're
again.
In no rush. I mean, there's no rush. Don't rush yourself to a firefight.
Yeah.
There's no rush. It's going to be there.
Yeah.
And, but again, miscommunication, people not talking correctly, guys trying to do the right thing. You know, the guys decided, nope, we're going to go and we're going to land on key terrain. And the rest is history. I mean, you can read about it.
Now, you think we've learned anything from the C2 mistakes and everything and the guys trying to, you know, I grew up in a world where tactical commander, always got the benefit of the doubt. You know, and even to this day, I'm a retired guy and I sit back and people ask me to comment on things I read. I refuse to do that. And I said, look, I'm smart enough to know that I can put 10 guys that were on that same operation together and you're going to get 10 different stories.
Right.
So I don't comment on stuff like that. Yeah. I just, somewhere in there, there's the truth. Those tactical commanders know what they all did. Each one of them will see something different. But do you think we, you know, in those days, we deferred everything to the guys forward. It seems like that didn't happen during this operation. Do you think we learned anything as a community from overriding the tactical commander? Especially a guy like you and Pete. This wasn't your first dance. This wasn't your first dance at rodeo. Those NCOs knew what the hell was going on.
Oh, no. Yeah,
they've been in many a gunfight.
Absolutely. You know, I think we continue to, you can go back and look at Grenada. You can look at Somalia. You can look at Takugar, you know?
Yeah, great point. Those are all three. You got to relearn your lesson. You make
simple
mistakes.
And every so many years, you relearn those lessons. Did we learn a lesson in the community, the soft community at all? Absolutely. I think we learned it. I don't know where we are now. But even in the business world now, you know, I being in Raleigh, I can't make a decision for my guy who's in Kobani, Syria. If he tells me something, how do I override him?
Yeah, you pretty much got to go with his vote.
I got until I can get there, and I got to trust that guy on the ground.
Now, you've been out. What year did you get out?
I got out in 2007, right at the end of 2007. So, I mean, at the end of the day, I just knew I didn't want to work for somebody ever again, and I wanted to, you know, I think 9/11, AFO, my time at the agency kind of lit that entrepreneur light in me. I probably always had, but I didn't realize it. And I just said, okay, I've done this for 25 years and now I'm going to go try something by myself. And if I'm going to make it, I'm going to make it on my own. If I'm going to fail, it's going to be my fault. I just couldn't see myself going back and, you know, being a GS guy and working for a guy who was my lieutenant, you know, or whatever. I just thought we could do something different. And at the end of the day, you know, we based everything off of problem solving. I mean, you can talk all day. We do this. We build that. You know, we bill cans. But at the end of the day, you're a problem solver. Find a problem. Let's fix it and help someone fix it and charge them to do that.
Ray Donovan. I love it, though. You know, so you started Tiger Swan. And, you know, you and I've talked about this a lot. You know, like you didn't want to do anything with DOD. It's too painful, too complicated. But you guys did you started out on the security side, right?
Yeah.
But I love it. You told me one day, I started out as a security company, and now I'm a software company.
Software company. Yeah. Well, you know, we really started as a training company because that's what we kind of knew, you know, how to train.
With the range complex. No.
But before this, I mean, this wasn't the reality yet. We always thought, wouldn't it be cool to have the type of money to do this? But so we would just find little places we could train. But really, the thing that really kicked us off was our first job was we became a linguist company. We provided hundreds of interpreters for DOD in Iraq. You know, so we got on one of the big contracts, and we were disabled veteran small business. So we got we had 240 Arabic linguists in Iraq, and then. The company that had the prime, the big company said, oh, we need security for that. What are we going to do? I can do that too. You know? So now we're doing security for all of the 1100 linguists and moving them around the battlefield in Iraq. And that's just how we really started. We got, you know, we got lucky.
So I just sat down at a table with two young NCOs 18 to 15 years in SF, third group guys. Pretty sure they're going to get out at 20. One is trying to start a few companies, wants to become an entrepreneur. What would you say to a kid, a young person, you know, and when you have 20 years in, you're still young, despite what you think. But when, you know, they're getting ready to get out of the military and stuff, and they're going to transition into the civilian world, what would be some that you would, you know, impart upon those people?
So the first thing I would say is find a good lawyer who won't, you know, charge you an arm and a leg, and be compliant and understand contractually. What does that mean? It drives me crazy when someone from DOD signs a contract, and when something happens, first thing they say is, I didn't know that. And it's, you know, unfortunately, we baby our special operators, you know, because we want them to focus. But until they're walked out the door, we're doing everything for them a lot of times on the administrative side. So, you know, I tell guys, look, if you sign a contract, take it, spend the $250-$300, have a lawyer explain to you what, you know, compliance is, what non-circumvention means, what these big legal term means that can get you into trouble. And I think the other thing I would tell people is, you know, if you're going to provide a service, provide the best service or product you can, and just work faster than your customer. That's what I find is we're successful when we have a customer, but we're faster than the customer.
Awesome. Well, hey, thank you so much for doing this, Jim. It's been great. We really appreciate you.
And I want to thank the GSOF, the Global Soft Foundation. Thanks for coming out here and using us. And you guys have really provided an incredible tool for the community. And I thank you for that.
Thank you. Soft Spot is brought to you by the Global Soft Foundation, a 501c3 based in Tampa, Florida. If you're new to us, you can find out more about the foundation at gsoft.org. That's Golf Sierra October Foxtrot.org.